I managed to find an AI natural voice reader, text-to-speech.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, now, these are usually pretty rubbish.
Yeah.
I was listening to it. I put the text to it. It was their trial version. I got some Australian guy read it to me. It was uncannily like someone was genuinely reading it to me. It was really odd. Like it was someone in my head properly. Like it sounded That's like weird. A proper conversation. Uh-huh. It was the emphasis on the certain points was pretty much right. there and mm-hmm. it flowed really nicely. And I thought, oh, that's odd.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Because I've noticed on YouTube more and more, there are obviously AI generated things.
Mm.
Like the text isn't human text.
Mm.
The images are just blatantly stock images and the voice sounds weird, but it does still sound weird. It kind of sounds like this. It doesn't sound like a human. It sounds weird.
Yeah, and I've noticed some YouTube videos as well, but this one in particular, like you could just about tell it wasn't a human speaking.
Well, it was Australian. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the reason why. Oh, should we hit the music?
Yeah.
Welcome to the Gaps in Knowledge podcast. I'm Reese, and I'm a geographer that knows nothing about history.
And I'm Will, I'm a historian. I know nothing about geography.
And in this week's episode, I give meaning to those rain percentages, sing sex, drugs, and sustainability, and end up knee deep in swamplands.
And I'm you, ogre. And I'm off on expeditions. It's holiday time. Let's go on an adventure. We're going to catch up with Columbus, and we're going to have larks and escapades with Lewis and Clark. And then we are going straight to the moon. Enjoy. That was pathetic.
We'll keep it in.
All right.
We haven't done this because we pre-recorded quite a lot of these.
Yeah.
So we haven't done this about probably 3 weeks now.
It's been a while.
I don't even know who's to go first or who's to go second. But just before we begin, if this ever makes the cut. My cousins came over to Germany a few days ago.
Excellent.
Helen and Chris and their two boys, Ben and Ollie, and they listened to the podcast. I listened to driving here.
Ooh.
Which is quite cool.
That's hopefully the child-friendly episodes we've been putting out recently.
Yes.
There's some ideas flashing through my mind from series one. Don't know if I want to be listening to that with my parents as young boys.
No. But they thoroughly enjoyed it. Just a big shout out to them.
Excellent.
And they were enjoying it.
Excellent. Yeah. Ask your parents when you're older.
The thing is, we're saying child friendly. My main part is a bit now like worried.
Oh dear. Oh dear. But do we have to enter the no nan zone again?
It's not necessarily no nan zone. Okay. It's just maybe this is like PG light, my middle section. Just
okay. Maybe we could do some content warnings at the start.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
There may be some in the title, there may be subtle references to, the title was Sex, Drugs and Sustainability.
Okay. That's okay.
That's okay, right?
I feel like that's okay.
Okay.
I mean, we're not aiming this at like four-year-olds.
No. And if a four-year-old understands that, I think there's a parental problem there.
Yeah, exactly. That's your fault, not our fault.
Okay, is that enough content warning?
Well, I don't know what you've got lined up for us.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens.
Should we jump into
Misconception Corner?
Yes, absolutely.
Do you want to go first?
Okay, but I'm going to issue a content warning, which is we're talking about Christopher Columbus. So
is that in general a content warning moment?
It is.
Okay.
He's not a great person. So my Misconception Corner is, I presume I'm going first.
Yes,
I am now.
You are now.
Isn't who discovered America, because we all know who discovered America, right? Who discovered America?
Is that Christopher Columbus?
It wasn't Christopher Columbus. That's the misconception. Oh, you've fallen for that.
I can't have a double whammy. It has been a while then.
It has been a while. No, Christopher Columbus did not discover America.
Well, I was about to say it's already there. Well, someone has to discover it. Like,
it was definitely already there. The clue is in the fact that when he gets there, there are people there.
Yeah, there are Native Americans, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes, there are millions of them.
Yeah.
So you can't really say you discover it if you turn up and there's other... Eddie Izzard has a whole sketch about this.
Is that saying Buzz Aldrin discovered the moon?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Speaking of which, that does come up later in my number time.
Oh, God, okay.
he was the first European to permanently settle there. That's the effect. He set up the first colony that existed forever there.
Okay.
Yeah. But the first Europeans to get there were Vikings. Andrew Carr, what are you doing?
I'm just trying to get into the close to the mic because I realize I'm leaning forward and I want to have to watch this.
Can I just say, ladies and gentlemen, it's times like this, so you should be very glad this is an audio only experience.
Oh, dear.
Reese is kind of, he's got one of these big gaming chairs and it looks quite frankly like a baby chair for a car. And he's really snuggled into it.
But I was just trying to get comfortable with moving the mic. And what I did, I kind of like thrusted myself forwards towards Will to get my face to the mic. So I didn't have to really lean into it.
Very threatening.
It was quite threatening. And a little
content
bit... it was slightly promiscuous as well. They didn't mean to be. Anyway, Christopher Columbus is
otherwise. Christopher Columbus, yeah. So, no, my main misconception is, where was he from?
Okay.
So where do you think Columbus, he was from?
Well, didn't... I know... correct me if I'm wrong, didn't he leave from Spain?
Yes.
I know he left from Spain.
Yes.
And he was funded by the Spanish or the Portuguese?
Funded by the Spanish.
Okay, that's... I may have got that information from a Bill Voigt's video.
Fine, we'll take it.
But that's as much to know. So Christopher Columbus, that sounds like it could easily be a British name.
There's a good reason for that. It's because that's not actually his name at all.
A what?
His name was Cristoforo Colombo.
That's not British.
No.
If someone from Britain is called that, they've got some really left-wing parents.
Yeah, left-wing or Italian parents.
Yeah, or that
as
well.
Which is also possible.
And they're famously left-wing.
my sister lives in Italy and I texted her yesterday to say, like, I've been watching some Italian football and everyone seems really angry. Are Italians okay? And she said, no, they've just banned ChatGPT.
Yeah.
And they've also banned English phrases from the language. And they've banned, what else was it? Insect-based flour, because that goes against their cultural heritage.
They're mad. I can see why they're angry.
Yeah. It's not, I mean, at least they're not doing a Brexit. Like,
that's true. Although if you were to say, name a country in Europe that is most likely or vulnerable to do a Brexit, Italy would be at the top of that
list. Italy would be very high up on that list, absolutely. Yeah, so strange people, the Italians, not having a great time at the moment.
No.
But that's where Christopher Columbus was from. He's from Genoa, from the city of Genoa in northeast Italy. And then he moved to Spain. They gave him all the money. And then he set off for the New World. And discovered it in inverted comments.
Okay, why would we call him Christopher Columbus when he has an Italian name? What happened there?
Because it's basically his Latin name. Colombo becomes Columbus. Christopher is a Greek kind of name. Christophorus is what it would be in Latin.
So he's been anglicized.
He's been anglicized, exactly.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, which, I mean, that happens quite a lot. Like with Jean Cabot, the French reformer, we call him John Cabot.
That's quite fun just to do as an anglicizing person.
Yeah.
To anglicize, like, when we were in Belgium at some point when mm-hmm. we were trying to, I just like enjoyed anglicizing all of the Belgian names. Well, Bastogne mm-hmm. is where we stayed.
Yeah. But we do that kind of thing quite a lot. Like, and trying to figure out, I've been watching a lot of German TV to learn German, trying to figure out where they're talking about. Like, wir sind hier in die Stadt von Mailand. Where's Mailand? Do you mean Milan?
Milan.
But it's not called Milan, it's called Milano.
Oh.
So we do it too.
Yeah, so okay, fair enough. It's like, but they have different, like, very common to have different countries with different names, don't they? So mm-hmm. like Alemão is German in French and Portuguese?
Portuguese, yeah. But the Italians call it Tedesco and we call it Germany and they call it Deutschland.
It's weird.
Very weird.
It's like Russland is Belarus.
Mm-hmm. Although Belarus in Belarusian means white Russia.
Oh, so that makes sense.
That kind of makes sense. It's been translated.
So actually, England have screwed that up.
Yeah. Well done, us.
Yeah, right. Congrats. Anyway, that's a tangent and a half.
So, I mean, there's two other people who may have discovered the Americas first. One was this Viking I mentioned called Leif Erikson. That is Europeans who got that first.
Leif.
Leif. L-E-I-F.
L-E-I-F.
Good name.
That is a cool name.
And he got there, we're not entirely sure, but coming from Iceland.
Okay.
And set up possibly a colony somewhere in Canada. But there was also a Chinese fella called Zheng He, who got there in the early 15th century, so about 100 years before Columbus, potentially.
Uh-huh.
But either way, there'd been human beings there for 12,000 years.
Yeah, that I think it's a little bit harsh, because there would have been someone before that discovered it 12,000 years ago, yeah, who stumbled upon it, and tectonically would have looked different anyway.
Yeah. And I mean, did the Normans discover England in 1066?
So this is the question really here. It's not, it's a question of what do we mean by the term discovered something?
Yeah. Yeah. Was he was the first European to bring knowledge back to Europe of this place.
Yes.
That's reasonable. So he was the first person in the world to find it is quite racist. Yeah,
and just like, for like wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So Christopher Columbus, big on mutilations, big on massacres.
Okay.
But not Spanish.
And that is the three things I've learned today. Okay, shall we go on to my misconception corner?
Let's do it.
I hope this misconception corner actually turns out to be quite practical as well for everyone listening and for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be surprised. I don't know. Will you know this? Okay. So you open your favorite weather app on your phone. Yep. Okay. You must have a favorite one.
I have a rotating selection of several.
Of course you do. Why would you have just one like a normal person?
That's not true.
It states 40% chance of rain today.
Aha. Right.
Okay. What is the chance there'll be rain today?
Right. Yeah. Okay. This is actually a good question, because I would have thought 40%, but obviously otherwise I wouldn't. Okay. So what is going on there? Why is it lying to me? The absolute melt.
Well, okay. So I can understand your confusion and your anger at that, because it would make you think, oh, it says 40%, fury, therefore there's 40% chance it's going to rain. But what does that actually mean? Like if I flipped a coin, there is a reason I chose 40% rather than 50%. Like, but if we hypothesize 50%, if we flipped a coin and it was heads, the rain, tails, no rain. But that's not actually accurate what the app is trying to tell you.
Right.
Which is annoying for the regular person, because that's what you would assume.
Yeah.
But it's not. So the percentage is not so... let's rephrase it. So you might like to think the percentage of rain is predicting how likely it is that your back garden party will be interrupted by an unexpected shower.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so much more complicated than that, which is really annoying. Okay. We just want to know if it's going to rain or not.
I just want to know if I should take an umbrella.
So according to meteorologists, the percentage is the chance of rain given at any point in the area that it is covering in that area. So for example, if let's say our backyard was the area of where the data is being collected from, and 50% means 50% of the area will experience some rain today.
Uh-huh.
Is what that really means.
Right.
So if we imagine Duisburg, where we are now, if there's a 40% chance of rain, what it really means is 40% of Duisburg will experience rain today.
40% of the time it happens, 100% of the time.
Exactly.
Right.
That's what it means.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
So that's how the 40% works.
Right.
And so if we could sort of look at an example to kind of like to hone in a bit better. So say you're having a garden party, you check the weather app and it says 40% chance of rain. So that means 40% of the forecasted area is expected to have rain within a certain time frame, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it will definitely rain on your party. So however, there is a way you can work out the likelihood of there being rain on you on that day. And this is where it gets a little bit mathematical. So there's a formula that meteorologists can use. By the way, meteorology, it is just blokes in tweed jackets pretend to be good at physics.
Okay.
That's essentially what meteorology is. That's pretty hard on... Was it Michael Bird? Michael Fish.
Yeah.
He was an animal. who said famously that there would be a hurricane in the coming to the UK. What he meant to say was there'll be hurricane strength winds.
Right.
Not actually a hurricane. Do you know we get storms over the UK from west to east?
See, I mean, look, it's basically nonsense. It's educated guesswork, but it's still guesswork.
Yeah, but it's educated guesswork. It's got a lot better over recent.
Tell you what else is educated guesswork.
Go on.
Astrology.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as educated, I'll give you that.
No.
It's still definitely guesswork.
It is guesswork, but then Yeah, but the difference between meteorology and astrology is, yeah, in terms of guesswork, is that astrology, you kind of can make up an answer and therefore say it's true, whereas we will actually find out what will happen in a particular air with the weather.
Well, I mean, all I'm saying is there is a 50% chance of anything happening because it either happens or it doesn't.
So I'm going to buy a lottery ticket. So my chances of winning the lottery are 50%.
It either happens or it doesn't.
I win it or I don't.
Exactly.
But I not win it most of the time.
Yeah.
So
that's what an A level in maths will get you.
There's something wrong with that statistic. God. At school, I dropped AS mathematics, and one of them was I got an E in maths. Uh-huh. And I remember doing a statistics module, and it was the only one I was half decent at, because then I did it at university, and it was my highest ever score on any module at university. Mm-hmm. I got 95%.
Oh, wow.
Which I was very happy with.
Yeah.
the rest of my grades were just distinctly average all the way through. But yeah, so that's why... That's why your statistic there is stinky.
You're not happy about that.
That's rubbed me up the wrong way. But there is a formula, and it's called the POP, which is the percentage of precipitation,
right,
which I quite like as a
quantum pop. That makes sense.
And it's percentage of precipitation equals C times A, where C stands for confidence of rainfall and A stands for area. So... yeah, and this is where my mathematics sort of fell down a little bit when I was researching this. I couldn't find anything concrete. Mm-hmm. But it says, like, if there's a 50% chance of rain in an 80% given area, your probability of rain becomes 40%.
Yeah. Okay.
So times into fractions together, essentially.
Right.
Is what you're doing here.
And what they're giving us in the app is the second of those two figures, the area of rain.
The area of rain, not the actual percentage, how much it will rain on you.
But they have... the formula.
They have the formula which they could convert to give you the statistic which everyone thinks it stands for. So
but
what are they doing?
They're not going to do that.
Why are they not doing that?
Forbidden knowledge.
Yeah, the forbidden knowledge that no one's allowed to know. That's really odd. Why wouldn't you give that information? The only thing I can think of is because people move between areas of their weather app. But then again, you just update the statistics. What are they doing?
Why are they not? Because it's not... where I thought this was going is you were going to say it is impossible to be able to tell you what the chance of
rain
is.
No, you can work it out.
So why don't...
Why aren't they doing that? That's just an epiphany for me suddenly.
Is this a gap in their knowledge that we've spotted?
Yeah, maybe.
Is this a very minor gap in
I told you, meteorologists are just physicists in tweed jackets that... Yes, they're astrologists. You're right.
See?
They're totally astrologists. You're absolutely right.
There you go,
the
moon's in Scorpio and there's a 50% chance of rain. Should I take my umbrella or not? That's all I need to know.
Yeah. And do you know what? When you go out of your umbrella, there's a 50%, it either will or it won't rain.
Exactly. Either it did rain or it didn't. Even if you're in the Sahara, 50% chance.
Better safe than sorry.
Have I ever told you about the time I stayed in a farm in Australia on a rugby tour? And
there was a kangaroo in
the... Yeah, somebody punched a kangaroo, and the guy in the farm was a cattle auctioneer. And he spoke the whole... You know what cattle auctioneers sound like, right?
Yeah, yeah. They talk really quickly, don't they?
Yeah. That's how he spoke the whole time.
Yeah. I think you told me about how there's an
Very
episode
frightening.
Once.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Well, then I shan't do my impression.
Spare us.
It is... You're welcome. It is Easter holiday time, which means that my theme for this week is expeditions. Have, at the risk of getting political, how much schadenfreude are you taking at the moment in the queues at Dover?
How much schadenfreude? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, do you know what, right? I haven't... My family came over recently, like just for a day, and but they didn't go to Calais. They did the long overnight ferry from mm-hmm. somewhere from Norfolk, mm-hmm. So they didn't experience that so much. But I understand that there's a lot of queues there at the moment, and that is quite funny, mm-hmm. actually. Sorry, Mum.
I mean, the British did do it to themselves. So.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a hashtag going around at the moment. It says rejoin. EU rejoin or something like that. I think there's
funny that.
Yeah.
Know what you've got till it's gone.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I'm just happy I don't have to experience all of it.
And that was Smug Corner featuring two EU residents. So my main event is all about a big expedition, which I'd kind of heard of. Maybe some people had kind of heard of, but I didn't know why people were bothered about it. It's called the Lewis and Clark Expedition.
Okay.
Has that ever come across your radar?
Never.
So what the Lewis and Clark Expedition was in 1804, we're going back over 200 years, mm-hmm. the Americans bought a whole chunk of land off the French called the Louisiana Purchase. And it's part of the United States today. It's basically the whole of the Mississippi and then going up west.
Okay.
This is, I got interested in it from that episode we did about the Mississippi.
Yes.
Which is longer, the Mississippi or the Missouri.
Yeah, and the Missouri being 100 miles longer or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And that got me so angry.
Yeah, I can imagine it would do.
That
yeah.
I had to go and research it because that's what I do when I'm angry. And it turns out, yeah, that was all bought off the French. And it's a huge amount of land. It's 8 times the size of Germany. Like massive amount of land. It's like France buying 4 Switzerlands.
Okay, have the French tried to do that in the past?
and improve upon Switzerland quite considerably by doing so.
Yeah.
So, there's the Swiss ticked off our list. Yeah. So what President Thomas Jefferson decides in between abusing his slaves is he needs to send somebody to go and check out this territory.
Mm-hmm.
8 times the size of Germany, he picks 2 people to do it.
That's a big job.
I would argue it's not quite enough people. And he says, you got 2 years.
Whoa, okay.
Go and map the whole place. And
I mean, that's a job. And it's, I mean, we're in an era where there's no satellites, no nope. GPS, nope. Nothing.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. They do have slaves, which is helpful.
That is helpful.
If cruel. But that's all they've got. So a couple of slaves, a couple of shoes. One of them's called Meriwether Lewis. Excellent name for a hobbit.
That's very good.
And the other one's called William Clark, which
that's
is
very boring.
Mediocre. So kind of 3 out of 10 and 8 out of 10, I'd say.
Is that how you measure slaves? Is that what their names are?
Oh, no, these aren't the slaves. These are the people.
Okay. Is this how you measure the people is based on their names?
is that how you measure slaves? That's how I measure people. Absolutely. Yeah.
But based on their name.
How creative were their parents?
Yeah.
Yes. I tend not to measure slaves. No.
I just realized how I sound. Out of context, that's an awful thing to say. And I hope no one snips that.
Just measure them in horsepower. So what they do is they head all the way up the Mississippi. Parts of it they already know, like where the Louisiana Bayou is, where the Mississippi comes out. They already know that because mm-hmm. that's New Orleans. So they go up the Mississippi and then they go up the Missouri and they end up in modern day North Dakota. And that's pretty much the extent of knowledge at that point in time. Everything they knew up until then had come from buffalo hunters.
Okay.
And had come from beaver hunters. Do you know why people hunted beavers?
Is it because they were annoyed they were damming up the river?
It's not. And funnily enough, I've been ill recently. And when I get ill, I get into weird things. And one of the things I've been getting into is rewilding. Beavers, they're crazy good. Do you know what rewilding is?
No, I've got a lot to learn there. Oh, firstly, what's rewilding?
So rewilding, it's a new geographical movement, which is... it's a climate change movement.
Okay.
Taking care of the natural world by allowing it to do what it wants.
Oh, the do nothing approach.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there's a little bit of management involved. So it's reintroducing old species. It's Ooh. Letting, for example, take a farm that's been farmed for 400 years. There's no nutrients in the soil anymore.
No.
It's all the water's just running off straight into the river, causing floods. So if you let it grow fallow for a couple of years, then the grasses can start to spread and build up roots.
This is the crop rotation approach they use in the Amazon yeah. for the tribes do this. They use the land for a period of time, then they migrate, move on, and that mm-hmm. land can regenerate, which will do over hundreds and hundreds of years again. Mm-hmm. It's unlikely someone to go back to it. And
yeah.
This is how farming practices like nomads would work. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So rewilding is the controlled measure of
yeah.
this.
Yeah, but then you introduce species to that as well.
Oh, cool.
That's and species, really cool. So the idea is introduce deer, they can manage the grassland. Introduce wolves, they can manage the deer.
So it's a re-nullifying effect of the biosphere.
Yeah, it's taking humans out of it
and okay.
in a managed approach. And one idea is get beavers involved because they can dam up rivers that gets water to spread out into the local area.
Do they brief them before that? That's what you're doing.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Sorry, just for interject, I like this idea. take humans away, things go back to normal and how they
funny
should
that.
Be.
Yeah. And I mean, so George Monbiot, who's a journalist in the UK, he's written loads of books about this. And one of his books called Feral, he writes about how natural parks in the UK, if you think of the Lake District, like, have you been to the Lake District?
Yes.
Tell me what you see in your mind's eye when you think of the Lake District.
Mordor, like, it's kind of like, well, I meant to see kind of these like green hills and that come down from valleys and stuff like that. That's what I meant to see.
Very pretty.
Yeah.
How many trees can you see?
Absolutely none.
Do you know why?
Because they probably uprooted them all for XYZ, either cultivation or for the logs themselves as a resource.
For sheep.
Okay,
to make land for sheep, and the sheep just eat all the baby trees as soon as they start sprouting.
So you just absolutely decline you reduce the biodiversity significantly.
Completely. Yeah. And hills without trees don't have root systems, so all the water just washes off.
Yeah, so you get a huge amount of surface runoff, bang, floods, woof.
And that image that you have of kind of the Highlands of Scotland being all purple and orange, there were large forests there. They're only purple and orange because nothing else grows there anymore because it's all being eaten by the sheep. But that's how natural reserves are seen in the UK. Mm. You kind of pause it at some point in the 1850s and say, everything's been destroyed except for what sheep can manage. So let's keep it like this. Let's protect the species now, not protect the species that used to be here before we came and messed it all up.
Isn't it only that 1% of natural forest is still there in the UK? I think it's a new forest in the south that still
there's
have
a little bit of original forest there.
Yeah.
But that's the idea, is to replant these forests if you have a forest, if you have a field next to a field, then the runoff from there is just going to destroy the land.
Yeah.
If you have a field next to a forest, then the nutrients from the forest can get into the field.
You just hope that when the rewilding takes place, that humans as a result then don't go down that line of, now we've got all these natural biodiverse resources, we're going to then just recultivate
it. Yeah, just ruthlessly exploit it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. And that's why I think you should also rewild big bears. Get bears back in the UK to protect the forest from people. So, not a popular opinion.
No. I was on the internet recently on Reddit, and there's a nice little phrase that you can use to know how to, if you encounter a bear in its natural environment. I think it's, if it's brown, fall down. Mm-hmm. If it's black, fight back.
Yeah.
If it's white, say goodnight. Which I really like.
If you come across a polar bear, you're in trouble.
Yeah. Which is why in Yellowknife in Canada, it is illegal to lock your car.
Uh-huh.
We've spoken about that before. So people can go into cars if there's a polar bear and wandering around.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Beavers and stuff.
Why do you hunt beavers? Two reasons. One, because their fur makes good hats, not their hats make good fur.
Although beavers have hats.
They do have good hats.
They do.
Their fur makes good hats. Number two is because, is this child friendly? Yes, it is. There's a part of the beaver's digestive system which is very good for perfumes. It smells like vanilla.
Oh, that's
way down in its bum.
Oh, that's an unfortunate characteristic to have for a beaver.
It is. It is, yeah. And so, I mean, I think still to this day, a lot of perfumes that smell like vanilla come from beaver bums.
Okay.
So that's nice.
Well, that is... Why do you know that?
That's just basic general knowledge.
So, I'm sorry, that is fundamental knowledge we should all have.
Absolutely.
I'm the idiot here.
Yeah, completely. Sunrises in the east.
Yeah, right.
Beaver bums smell like vanilla. So
must have missed that lesson in primary school.
Taste unreported. Let us know if you happen to know what beaver bums taste like by hitting that little phone-in button on Spotify.
Yeah, it's just down below.
Yeah. So, I've skipped ahead in my notes.
Yeah, I noticed at some point, like we've got more tangents than normal, I think.
Oh, no, I hadn't. No, the last thing I'd written here is two idiots with no idea, which I don't know if that's referring to Lewis and Clark or us. So, we're talking about Lewis and Clark and their big expedition to go and map the West of America. And they meet a couple of important characters whilst they're up in the winter of 1804. They go to the Dakota people and they say, we don't know what we're doing. We're two idiots. We've got no idea. Just like us.
Just like us.
What should we do? And they say, well, look, first of all, you need to make a fire and they need to make a hut and they need to get some food. And they're, oh, yeah, good ideas. Thanks for telling us. And when they're up there with those Dakota people, they meet a French guy called Toussaint Charbonneau.
Good name. Well
Very
said.
French.
Good to your French degree is paying off.
And in terms of student loans, it is absolutely not. He is a tradesman. He kind of wanders around the different tribes selling them stuff, which is quite a cool job to have in this point in time.
Pretty cool.
And he's got a wife And his wife is called Sacagawea.
Again,
a very good name.
Good name.
And Sacagawea is pregnant at this point in time. So they've got a son on the way. And Charbonneau is basically useful because he can talk to people, but he's very drunk. Sacagawea, on the other hand, she's a pretty remarkable person. She, if she hadn't have been a woman, she would have been the leader of this campaign for sure. She's pretty excellent. So they set out, they start mapping everything, and nothing of interest really happens until they start to move on in the spring of 1805, when they get attacked by bears. So two of their scouts, a guy called Hugh McNeil and John Coulter, they're off scouting a path when all of a sudden they come across a group of baby grizzlies.
What color are they?
Grizzly bears, brown bears.
Okay, so they should, it's too late now, my advice.
That's the thing, because especially, I mean, the only thing worse than coming across a bear in the wild is coming across baby bears in the wild.
Oh, yes.
Because you know that standing behind you is a mother bear.
Uh-uh.
And the only place you don't want to be with regards to bears is in between a mother bear and a baby bear, because it's just over.
There's a lot, out of all places to be in between.
Yeah.
That's not ideal.
No. So what should they do? A, run away. B, fire a gun and then run away. Or C, act dead.
I know what they did. Based on those three things, they definitely chose the middle option.
Yep.
Because that's the most ridiculous.
That's the stupidest thing to do. Yep. It's not recorded whether or not he fired at the bear. I like to think he just fired up in the air.
That's out of those two options, that is still the worst one.
Peg it. The mother bear, A, does nothing. B, charges. C, understands and tries to avoid the confusion by negotiating.
Again, I think I'm going to go with your middle option.
Absolutely. Yes. At this point, so they realize, crap, there's a mother bear. Oh no, there's the baby bear. We're stuck in the middle. We're mincemeat. So off goes the gun. One of them charges away. Coulter tries to distract the mother by kind of waving and going, hey, look at me, come and chase me, and then pegs it and then runs up a tree. Whilst McNeil, he just goes straight up a tree without trying to distract anything. Both of them somehow manage to survive.
What?
Because McNeil gets so far up the tree that the mother just chases Coulter. And Coulter manages on his way to kind of scramble up the tree. He does get knocked over by the bear, but it's not a knock that does too much damage. So he just flies to the ground and acts completely dead. And the mother goes, okay, he's dead now. He's not going to disturb my babies anymore. And they just run away.
If climbing, there's a question now. Could you climb a tree if your life depended on it? Like, I think I would struggle.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, there is a climbing wall in Duisburg, which is quite fun that I go to, but it goes from orange to blue to green to yellow to red to black.
So you need to find the correct colored tree.
Exactly. If there's a blue tree, 80% of the time I should be fine.
Yeah. Well, no, 50%, you either will or you won't.
I either will or I won't. That's true. 50% of the time I'll be fine. So yeah, I reckon it's coin toss.
Yeah. Most of life.
I'll be eaten or I won't. So by the time we get to February of 1805, no one's died. They're still mapping everything. Sacagawea gives birth in the middle of the wilderness. And the baby that they give birth to, now, as well as kind of dealing with these various tribes, negotiating their way through this ridiculously tough terrain, she's also carrying a baby.
Don't get in between her and the baby.
Well, you're not going to be able to, because she carries the baby on her back the whole time, which is very cute. But
it's quite cute.
She gets quite ill whilst giving birth, because they're in the middle of nowhere, and giving birth is pretty major.
It's a traumatic experience, short in this age, firstly.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I was going to make a joke about giving birth then being akin to taking a big poo, but that wouldn't be child friendly.
So that's also probably not that accurate, but
that bit out. So
we might keep that in.
Depends who's editing this episode, I guess. She's giving birth. She's having a really terrible time of it. She's bleeding, looking like she's going to pass out in the middle of nowhere. Toussaint Charbonneau says to Lewis, she needs some snake bite, like venom. She needs the venom of a rattlesnake.
Okay.
What? Trust me on this. It's medicine. You need to go and find a rattlesnake, milk it, and give me the venom. Are you sure that's the best? I can make some tea. I can get some blankets. You sure you need me to go and milk a rattlesnake? Yes, go milk a rattlesnake. Lewis tracks down a rattlesnake, mills the rattlesnake. They give the rattlesnake
venom. You made that sound so much easier than it really probably was.
I mean, like... the thing is, there's only one way to do it. So it's not like you need to hear the story. Like, you can imagine it, I'm sure.
Like, yeah.
There's a man milking a rattlesnake.
I bet if he spoke to him, he's got a story about that.
I mean, again, like, I feel like it's the kind of thing where... I mean, yeah... Well, there's only one way to do it. You have to grab the rattlesnake and then make it bite something and get the venom out.
I see.
How else
not actually
you
get
it?
Milk out of it, though.
No. It doesn't have udders. Or you don't kind of squeeze it like a tube of paint.
Just to be clear, this guy's not milking a rattlesnake. He's just getting the venom out of it.
That's what it's called, I think.
Really?
I think...
So it's a verb to extract a liquid from...
I've been to some weird places on YouTube, man. And I think I remember seeing that you can milk rattlesnakes for their venom. Now, I don't know why.
I'm sure it's a thing. And to now apply it to this country, they said that. Can you go and milk this rattlesnake? Or can you... I really hope so.
I mean, in my notes, I just wrote, give her some rattlesnake. So
you've added to this.
But I mean, what else could it be? It's not the meat. It's definitely not the meat.
No, fair point. I think we're focusing too much on this particular milking aspect, but...
It worked. It worked. Oh, hang on. No, it didn't. No, I just realized, cut that. Cut all of that.
It didn't work at all.
No, it's the rattle, not the venom.
You extract the rattle?
Well, somehow this is now even weirder, so maybe we don't have to cut all of that. Yeah, okay, so no, he didn't. He said, give her some rattlesnake rattle and that'll cure her from being sick.
What, the noise?
To eat.
Oh, the bit at the end, the tail bit.
Yeah, get the tail. Yeah, give her that to eat.
That goes really quick.
Yeah.
He wants that to eat.
Yeah.
Oh. Now, what's in there that makes it... Is it... I mean, you could feed her a maraca. That doesn't make sense.
Is it made of ibuprofen or something?
Like, maybe. I don't know.
Very strange. But either way, it works. And like little babies okay. born. And so like the point that I'm trying to make with these weird little anecdotes is they're in the middle of nowhere. They've got no idea what they're doing.
Do you know what this is? This is just chaos. This
it's
is
absolutely mental.
Chaos.
It is. And when you think of kind of an expedition, I think it's quite easy to think of kind of Admundsen type expeditions or Scott expeditions where you've got massive amounts of supplies, huge stores. We know exactly where we're going at the end of each day. These are two idiots in the middle of nowhere who have no idea what they're doing.
I imagine this is exactly how we would operate on this kind of expedition at this time.
Yeah.
This is exactly what we'd be doing.
Yeah. Like, give her a rattlesnake. Why? What do you mean, why?
just do
something. So, the way that they get about is by canoe. And the...
Why was that funny? Why did I laugh at that?
I mean, how else are you going to get about?
Yeah, why? Well, yeah, true.
I mean, it is the most idiot-proof method of getting about places,
it is.
I think.
It's just this.
Because there's only
sitcom.
One way you can go. Which way should we go? Upstream? Let's do that then.
Let's do that.
Because we're not going downstream because that's where we're coming from.
Yeah, true.
Idiot-proof. So, that's the thing.
That's
and these two bungling fools managed to be the first people to get over the Continental Divide, which is something we spoke about before. Can you remind us what the Continental Divide is?
So it's where the two watersheds of rivers meet. So if you put water one side, it flows into the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. If you put water the other side, it flows into the Pacific.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where they end up. So they are the first Europeans to cross that.
Continental Divide.
And from there, it's all downhill to Portland in Oregon, is roughly where they get to.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And they do all this in about a year. It doesn't take
that's
them that
pretty
long
good going, actually.
To go all the way from Washington, D.C., all the way over to the west of the U.S. It only takes them about a year.
Pretty good going, actually.
And they map the whole flipping thing. They record the botany and the fauna of the whole flipping thing. Like, they do a good job.
Proper cartographers.
Exactly. They do know what they're doing. And they get fairly confident, so much so by the time they get to July of 1806, so 2 years into the expedition, they decide to split up. Clark will go one way.
Oh.
Lewis will go the other way. And so Lewis is going to go into the Blackfeet territory, the territory of the Blackfeet people.
Okay.
And whilst he's there, he gets attacked quite badly. All of his weapons get nicked. He has to run away. And they end up running so far that they cover about 100 miles in a day.
That's a long way. That's a long
So you can imagine like these kind of details. And when it comes to like historical stories, you can kind of pick up on those details and then just go, yeah, cool. They ran 100 miles a day. No, put yourself into their shoes.
That's a long way.
They're in the middle of the forest. And no idea where anything is.
No roads, no streets. This is pure, like that's hard to do.
And all they can, they don't know that they're being followed by people. They don't know that there's anyone else out there. They just go to sleep one night. Exactly. They wake up, all of their weapons are gone and they know that they're next. They just got to peg it for 100 miles.
That's a feat in itself.
We've all done a runner at some point in our lives, normally down to the end of the block and then round the corner and you're safe. 100 miles.
It's a hell of a distance. Hell of a runner.
So it's not going great for them. Clark, amongst the Crow people, gets half of his horses stolen. Not going great for him either. But they manage to meet up eventually and they get back to Washington at the end of 1806, having basically charted the whole West. So they're the first people to cross over the Continental Divide. They're the first people to see Yellowstone, that massive volcano, super volcano in the national park. First people to go to Montana. And they were the first people to contact 70 different native tribes. So the whole Pacific Northwest region is there and is charted because of Lewis and Clark.
Nice.
And they're just two bungling idiots, most of it.
I like him.
Yeah.
I think we would have done the same thing.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably.
Okay, so my main part, as we probably alluded to this somewhere, but it's sex, drugs, and sustainability. Mm-hmm. And you probably know where the actual original phrase comes from.
Sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Exactly. And we are talking about...
Can I guess?
Go on.
Amsterdam.
It doesn't actually appear in my notes as such. Huh. But I know why you would have said Amsterdam.
Been in the news a lot recently about trying to move everything out of the center to make it more sustainable.
Uh-huh. I didn't know, actually. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Okay. That might appear in a future episode then. but this one in particular is about music festivals.
Uh-huh.
And the greening of music festivals.
Right.
That's a bit there. But yeah, the sustainability of music festivals and what they're doing wrong and what they should be doing right, really. It's a bit messy. And we are actually coming up to the music season, music festival season. It's, I think, probably summer start already, but definitely a summer vibe. Have you been to any music festivals before?
Not really. I've been to a couple of small ones in the Southwest, but never any big ones.
Okay.
Because, you know me, I like music, but I like making music more than I like watching music. Mm. And when I like watching music, being surrounded by thousands of people in a muddy field, yeah.
It's an interesting experience. I've done one major festival in my life, and that was the Isle of Wight Festival in 2010. Mm-hmm. That was probably one stage in the middle, and the main stage, and then you've got some side tents. It was good fun, and I got horrifically drunk, and it was blisteringly hot, like 35 degrees. And, you know, and it was it was the first day of the holidays after exams at first year university.
Right.
So it was a very, you know, fun experience. And when I read through what I have here, remind myself of that. Yeah, I can. It totally resonates with the problem that as all music festivals have at the moment, which is linking to climate change, mm-hmm. and they're becoming a lot worse. There's two sides to this. It's what people look like they're trying to do right, and there's actually still the impact, which is still negative. And we get into this kind of area of like greenwashing and this kind of idea, which is very prevalent through music festivals. So from Glastonbury, which is obviously the famous one in the UK, to Belgium's Tomorrowland and Spain's Primavera Sound, music festivals across Europe are doing their part to try to become more sustainable by reducing their carbon footprint. That's the biggest thing, is their carbon footprints of music festivals are huge. Where would you say the carbon footprint comes from the most for music festivals?
I mean, traveling to get there must be a big thing.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
It's the traveling there. That's becoming quite tricky at the moment for a lot of event planners, is to try and manage where people are coming from. So The truth is, festivals are finding the task to be difficult to make them more, to reduce their carbon footprints. A report from the UK festival industry, which I really like, from the Vision 2025 Climate Action Network published in 2020, said that despite greater engagement and action around sustainable practices, the environmental impacts of the festival industry have gone up overall since 2015, driven by the growth of the industry, becoming more popular. Mm-hmm. And I suspect coronavirus had a big impact on that declining, and I wonder, it has a massive rebound where everyone wants now to go out to festivals, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. they can go to Tomorrowland for 2 years or something like that. Mm-hmm. This is we talk about names. Are you ready for one?
Okay.
Dogon Gursoy.
Dogon Gursoy. Wow, that's a good name.
Good name, right? Professor at the Washington State University and author of a book on the climate change impacts of festival tourism said, a lot of festivals emphasize waste reduction, but if you look at the overall picture of carbon emissions, it is dominated by travel.
Yeah.
And audience festival travel emits 11 times more climate pollution than waste does.
Right.
So like the big images that we have of Glastonbury Festival, all the tents left everywhere mm-hmm. and all of the bottles left everywhere. Mm-hmm. That's 11 times smaller in its carbon emission or an environmental impact than actually just traveling to the festival itself.
Yeah.
So that's the bit actually they need to try and fix on. But the transport issue is hard to fix as people over the world travel to festival sites.
Yeah.
And that's the thing.
That's the thing. Yeah. How do you get there?
Yeah, and so activists and scholars across the continent point to this and a lack of transparency over key sustainability data as major issues holding back the festival industry growth. So actually it's really hard to actually track this data as well about exactly how many emissions, because people are traveling from different ways. The catchment area is huge and dynamic. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. really hard to try and actually track the data to make use of it, to improve it. Mm-hmm. But it has a huge impact on climate change and carbon emissions holistically. Mm-hmm. It's a real problem.
Sure it does.
So for example, Belgium's Tomorrowland, a boast of green initiatives, eco-friendly recycling programs and partnership with like circular water companies. But they also draw criticism from party flights. So they, this is where they have like huge amounts of cognitive dissonance. They go, we're going to have all of this wonderful recycling. We're going to employ local people so there's not much travel, but we're also going to then support our local aviation companies to get people from over the globe to come here, like, right. And have party flights. Like,
whilst you're sat there drinking your cup of circulated water.
Yeah.
Which we know what that means.
Right.
As long as it doesn't have any lumps left in it.
It's fine, right?
Whilst they're flying people in left, right, and center.
Yeah. While you're drinking your premium grey water. Doesn't quite. Yeah, right. And this is where I get really bogged down with these kind of festivals, that you get a lot of like, I'm going to be, we may never be able to go to festivals again now. But like you get people that hold big signs that are all the peace, or like we're the ones that are going to try and change the world, but it's all like for show. It's a massive facade. People mm-hmm. are still traveling from all over the place to come to these festivals. Mm-hmm. And there's not much. And I personally think like the event organizers should do a lot more to be able to manage and control these factors. But I think ultimately it comes from the individual. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. where a lot
yeah,
of this...
it's the choices you make.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But there is hope. And I've literally written that in my notes.
Oh, nice.
But there is hope.
Okay. Okay. Excellent. Well, let's end it there.
It would be wise, wouldn't it? And this is and interesting you mentioned Amsterdam, because it's the Dutch Ministry of Infrastructure and Water Management mm-hmm. recognizes the impact festivals can have and stresses that others should be taking on the tips of the digital, which is is a festival which they have in the Netherlands.
Right.
They have some really good approaches to trying to mitigate a lot of these travel issues and mm-hmm. other problems as well linked to it. But the digital, which is GGTL, which is like, you know, there's a nightclub in Brighton that's called Digital, which was kind of phrased the same.
Classy.
Yeah, right. I used to go there quite a lot, actually. That's why I know that.
You said, I think it maybe crossed my mind once or twice that there was a place perhaps called Digital in Brighton. That would be- Flashback to you there with like a regulars, like... So you got your seat at the bar.
Yeah.
You've got a kind of buy 10, get a get the 11th massive like liter purple woo
you get like
cocktail for free
content, and then you get the the stamp card when you go in as well.
Yeah,
and you get
exactly. 10,
you can get your 11th one for free and all that kind of stuff. I was there quite a lot, fell asleep on the beach quite often there as well. but the Festival Digital in Amsterdam actually, it's won the AGF award. Do you know what AGF might stand for?
AGF.
It's a festival.
Good festival.
Nearly, it's a green festival.
That's close.
A green earth festival, sorry. Uh-huh. So yeah, a green earth festival. It won the award for the most sustainable electronic music festival in 2019. Now I have a problem with this though, because as you read further into that award, it becomes more and more specific. It won the Greener Festival Awards, the world's most sustainable,
nice.
That's good, electronic music festival in 2019.
Right.
You know, okay, but what did they do to win that award? So they created initiatives like a tool to analyze material, water, mobility, and energy usage during the event, which other festivals weren't doing. They weren't tracking that. So they were actually monitoring that of these numbers, limited parking spaces, which I think is a really good push, and providing cheap public transport, and partnered up with clean energy tech companies.
Amsterdam's pretty good for that kind of thing. Like you can like park and ride for dirt cheap, go and park underneath the Ajax Stadium and then get the tram in.
Yeah.
It's like, they do that thing pretty well in the Netherlands.
Yeah, and there's a huge amount of cycling. It's like we talked about Denmark before.
Yeah.
I think it's the same sort of thing. There's huge cycling culture they have there. And it literally is, you have to, when you're walking around, usually in cities you look out for cars, but in Amsterdam
look out for
the bikes,
yeah,
because it's just a wash with them. And I think that's a good way to go generally. So can festivals do anything about trying to become greener? So the discussion has begun, as it's never been more important for festivals to shed the risk of greenwashing, to stop showing off initiatives and actually enforcing them. And this is the big problem I have with huge global events, and I mean World Cup events, Olympics, always have this green washing approach.
Yeah.
And I hate it.
Yeah. Like the most egregious one I saw was, like I said, I've been ill, and so my name will just spend the time watching YouTube, and I kept on getting ads for Nutella, and the ad was, here's where we got our palm oil from, we're certified sustainable palm oil. Well, I mean, tell that to the orangutans.
Yeah, right, because they've got no homes anymore.
That's not and I wonder who's in charge of the sustainable palm oil initiative. Could it be like sustainable fish initiatives, which are basically run by the fish companies themselves?
Yeah, so they
like
do. Exactly right. It's like my favorite one is in the Qatar World Cup, and they were trying to advertise that it was sustainable stadiums, and they were built in a green way to be able to last in the future. And then they say, but we're going to air condition them all to keep them cool. And I think, what? You're in the desert. It's always, and particularly dry and warm in this area. Like, really, is this what, I mean, the problem lies holistically with the person that decided that it should be in Qatar in the first place.
Exactly. I mean, this is the problem. And the idea that individuals do have a role to play, absolutely. But they have a role to play in the same way that kind of individual drops of rain have a role to play in a thunderstorm.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you could not watch the World Cup, but it's still going to happen. Yeah, you could not go to the festival, but it's still going to happen.
And that's where the conflict comes of whether you should do something or not do something, and it's and that's where it's quite hard to make change. But talking about change, would you like three useful tips?
I thought you were going to give me something.
No, I can give you.
Here's 20 cents.
It's 20 cents.
Oh, thanks for spit with.
Yeah, but I can give you and the listeners three useful tips if you're going to go to festivals. It's probably good practice in life anyway.
Number one, circulate your own water. Cut out the middleman.
Well, I'm not going to say that.
Child friendly.
But what you could do is reduce single-use plastic consumption. So bring in a reusable water bottle and a durable bag to carry your belongings. That could be one way. There's a law in Germany now that says if someone comes in with a coffee cup of their own, you have to put the coffee in it. You can't reject that anymore. Like you have to, accept that and say, yes, this is a reusable mug. You put the coffee in it.
I thought you were going to say there's like a discount that you get 50 cents off.
No, right.
They can't refuse your service.
They can't really say absolutely not. No. But that's a
fair enough.
Which I think is a good movement. So that's one thing. So the other one is to choose sustainable and local transportation. And like, and also with carpooling, making sure that one of the things actually he did say was making sure that not only are you carpooling like four people in one car, but making sure your car is fully like maintained as well. And like, mm-hmm. you're driving appropriately, mm-hmm. like don't rev your engine like a maniac, like actually drive efficiently. That's one thing, genuinely, if everyone did that all at the same time, mm-hmm. the amount of carbon emissions was significantly reduced, particularly mm-hmm. in Europe and the States, like the way in which you operate a motor vehicle.
If people use their indicators, then I don't think the icebergs would melt. That's my bold prediction.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because the amount of times you get cut off by somebody just jumping in without using their indicators, then you've got to slam on your brakes. Mm. Then they've got to slam on their brakes behind. And then you've got to rev the engine up again.
Speed up again.
It's just a waste of petrol. You wasted the petrol to get you to the initial velocity.
I never
Now you're wasting
that.
It to rev it up.
And I've just tried to translate that into if I was on a push bike and someone came in front of me, I've got a brake and then used my own energy to get up to speed again. It's the same thing, isn't
same
it?
Same thing, exactly.
And then I sweat. Yeah.
Save a penguin, use your indicators.
Yeah, idiots. And finally, reduce your energy consumption and waste. I mean, these are all pretty good life advice anyway.
Yeah.
Like, we've probably said these many times before, but specifically to, actually, this one's quite good for specifically for festivals. If there are charging facilities available, use solar powered or mm-hmm. like kind of ones and only use green electricity. Go to festivals that generally have green electricity being generated for the festival. Mm-hmm. Be mindful of your waste. Never leave litter behind. Support organic and vegan food stands and bring your own coffee container, again, to reduce the amount of single-use items. And I think these are just good general culture changes that people should be adhering to moving forward. I think we could all be guilty as human beings of being environmentally unfriendly in certain aspects of our lives. Mm-hmm. But I don't think as a human being we should be limited to every single thing to try and reduce our eco and carbon footprint, but definitely be conscious of some of the ones that maybe you do use a lot of, like electricity, mm-hmm. the way in which you move around cities or the country, like mm-hmm. just and the food you eat, just, you know, make subtle, sustainable changes to your life. And if you could all manage that, then actually, you know.
Starts to make a difference. Absolutely.
It makes a huge difference.
I mean, it's very easy to ignore the fact that actions have consequences, but everything we do has a consequence. How you get to work has a consequence. How you get to the music festival as a consequence, that kind of thing. So a little bit of thought could help. And use your indicators.
Oh, yeah, that.
Number time?
Let's do it while I've got a mouthful of Pepsi Max.
So,
may I add, is in a recycled wine glass.
Ew. I mean, it does still very much look like a glass.
Yeah, but it's a...
By recycled, you just mean you cleaned it rather than smashed it on the floor like a Greek restaurant.
By recycled, it means we went to a company that sold these in particular and cut them up. And then
so bourgeois sometimes.
It is a little bit, isn't
unbelievably
it?
Unbelievably middle class.
I'm sorry.
But no need
me,
to apologize.
Middle class has never been said to me ever.
Well, I've got, well, good news or bad. Look at the amount of suede furniture you have in this room, Reese.
Yeah, it's a fair point.
You made it. So my number time is, the number is 12. And the good clue number. Is moon. 12 moon.
12 and moon. See, we alluded somewhere at the start when I mentioned Buzz Aldrin. Mm-hmm. Mentioned about space travel and
second
moons
man on
and
the
stuff.
Moon.
So this is obviously something to do with this. The first number is how many times have we been to the moon?
It is not how many times we've been to the moon, no.
Okay.
But you are very close.
How many times you've been to the moon?
I've never been to the moon.
Okay.
Can confirm.
How many people have been to the moon?
How many people have been to the moon is exactly correct. Yes.
Oh,
12
good.
People in total have been to the moon. Yeah.
Okay.
First one, do you know what the first one was called?
It's a funny one, isn't it? So isn't it, it's the guy really. That said the phrase was the third person on the moon?
Nope.
No?
Guy who said the phrase was the first person on the moon.
And that, but it wasn't Buzz Aldrin. Oh, this is because there's three of them, aren't there, in this expedition?
Yeah.
Like, and didn't he screw up the phrase as well?
Potentially a little bit. Yeah, it could have been a communications glitch.
Yeah. One small step for a man, he was meant to say.
Yeah.
Not one small step for man.
Yeah.
One giant leap for mankind, because it doesn't quite make
sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. But one small step for a man does make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he screwed up.
Yeah.
But he is on the moon.
But he is on the moon, to be fair. To be fair.
So who was the first? I don't know who the first.
Neil Armstrong.
So it is Neil Armstrong. Yeah. That was my next guess. I was foolishly slightly embarrassed because I genuinely should know that.
No, Neil Armstrong, son of Louis Armstrong, father of Lance Armstrong. I had you for a second.
I don't believe that.
For a second I had you.
I don't believe that. One's a cyclist, isn't he?
Yeah, Lance Armstrong's a cyclist. Louis Armstrong's a jazz trumpeter. Unrelated. No, Neil Armstrong. So July the 21st is when he stepped foot on the moon, 1969. And as you said, the second man on the moon was Buzz Aldrin. The third member of that mission, which was called Apollo 11, was called Michael Collins. And he never went to the moon. He was in the lunar orbit module. So he spent his time whizzing around the moon whilst they were on the surface.
Oh, massive FOMO.
Well, the thing, I mean, people did kind of ask him that. And he said, no, I'm still part of one of the most remarkable things human beings have ever done. Oh. And for the period of time that when he's orbiting the moon, there's a point where he goes behind the back of the moon. They're on the front of the moon. And so he is farther away from any other human being than any body has ever been. Ever.
Oh.
Because he's a moon's distance away from anyone else.
Lonely.
Pretty cool.
Figure.
Just hanging out.
Yeah. But just for those, FOMA means fear of missing out. If you didn't know that, by the way.
Exactly. And you can read all of the transcripts of the because they relay all their messages back to Houston, back to air control in Houston. You can read all the transcripts. And there's some great stuff in there. Like at one point, they say, well, you appear to have an unidentified flying object in the lunar module. What's going on? And Houston say, looks like there might be a slight leak in the toilet, and they come back and say, yeah, can confirm that is a floating frozen poo. Just little nice. Bits like that. It's good.
Isn't there a moment where that's where the dark side of the moon comes from, but they wasn't there a point where they went around the backs and lost all connection for a period of time?
Yeah. I mean, this is quite pivotal in Apollo 13, which is the mission that goes wrong, because they are out of communication for all human beings for, I think it's about half an hour. I think it takes them about an hour and a half to orbit around the moon. So they just don't have any communications at all.
It's terrifying.
For about half an hour. So who knows, kind of, whilst they're there, we don't know if they're going to survive or not, but they do obviously come back around and survive. But yeah, there are points where, I mean, the moon's in the way. There's no way of communicating.
That's terrifying to think of.
Spooky. So the last, well, the 12th man, the last person to first step foot on the moon, if you see what I mean. Was a guy called Harrison Schmitt, who was part of Apollo 11 in 1972. So it was only 3 years that there were Apollo missions.
Okay.
The last man on the moon was Gene Cernan. But he was the 11th man on the moon.
Okay.
So he stepped foot on the moon before Harrison Schmitt, but he got off after Harrison Schmitt.
Oh, I see. So there was, okay, that makes sense. So the first one in, last one out kind of approach.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the first ones there, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong, are the most kind of momentous. And when they're there, they collect some moon rocks. They set up some little reflector pads so that we can prove human beings have been to the moon by just firing a laser at the moon. And if you fire it at a very specific point, then you'll get a reflection coming back.
That's really cool.
Yeah, proves that we've been there.
That's
for
really
sure.
Cool.
There's no way it was faked. But they just stopped going. By the time you get to kind of Apollo 16, Apollo 17, they're doing things like playing golf on the moon. They're whizzing about in the lunar buggies. They kind of ran out of things to do.
They drop hammers and feathers and they fall at the same velocity.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think you can see footage of that.
Yeah.
And so the question is, why did they go to the moon in the first place? What's the point?
So what I find really interesting about this, is that a genuine question you're asking me?
Yeah.
Okay, so the reason I would think you go to the moon is because you can. Like, because it's a possibility.
Yeah.
Like, why would you climb Everest? Because you can.
Yeah.
I think it's the nature of humans to be explorative. What's the...
Explorational?
Explorational.
I don't know. To explore.
To explore.
To be curious.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, and that's pretty much what JFK says. It's John F. Kennedy laid down this marker because we're in the middle of the Cold War in the 1950s and 1960s. The USSR and the USA are competing to see who's got the strongest technology. And the USSR sends up the first satellite, sends up the first creature into space, a dog called Laika, absolute dog hero. They send up the first monkey into space and they send up the first human beings into space, the first man, called
Yuri Gagarin.
Exactly.
Yes.
And the first woman as well. And so the USSR have won the space race. Mm. So JFK says, fine, you've done all the easy stuff. We're going to do the hard stuff. We're going to get people on the moon and we're going to bring them back by the end of the 1960s.
That's pretty impressive.
Pretty impressive. He says this in 1962. he's, of course, murdered in 1963. Mm. And so the question is, what kind of country does the US want to be? Does it want to be the kind of country that does Vietnam, which, not a good thing to do with Vietnam, wouldn't recommend it. Or do they want to be the kind of country who sends people to the moon? So they decide, we're going to send people to the moon.
That's a better exploration. There's a better use of resources, isn't it?
And
much more peaceful use of resources.
Much more. Well, I mean, the thing is, the rocket that you send people to the moon on, all you need to do is take the end off and replace that with a nuclear missile.
And then you're causing all sorts of problems again.
Yeah, exactly. And the people who were involved in building these rockets, quite a lot of them, through something called Operation Paperclip, were Nazi rocket engineers. They were led by a guy called Walter Braun, who was literally the head of the V2 rocket engineering. Like, he designed the Nazis' best rockets.
Jesus.
And the Americans say, that Nazi stuff, we're going to ignore it if you build us some good rockets.
Okay.
And they did. So
there's a fact of just to try this last, isn't there a moment, and you might or might not notice, and I might misremember some of this, but there was a moment where there were Russian and American in space, and they had their own modules they were in, and they connected.
The International Space Station.
And they connect the space station, and it took a long time, like 2 or 3 weeks to get it right, because they weren't compatible and had to connect each other first. Mm-hmm. And they had to design it on the thing to then connect it to go across.
Yeah, it's still up there today. You can see it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. you can see it kind of, it looks like a comet whizzing across the sky. That's genuinely one of the tragedies of the last 2 years, is that Russia's pulling out of that. That's kind of a major sign that the world is changing.
Right.
Is the International Space Station, the Russians will not be involved with that anymore. They're pulling out of that. It will only be the Americans. So this is a great sign of international peace. It's now breaking apart, unfortunately. Yeah. But back to the Apollo, the Apollo mission. So Apollo 11 was the one that sent people first to the moon. You know what Neil Armstrong said?
So one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
I think I've mentioned what Buzz Aldrin did when he got to the moon before. If not, he takes a little pause before he gets down the ladder.
He says, get out of the way.
Yeah. People asked him, why do you take a pause? Were you kind of collecting your thoughts and thinking it through? And he said, no, I just needed to pee.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right.
But I think the most poignant one is when Michael Collins, on his trip around the moon, sees the Earth rising behind the moon. And when he gets back to Earth, some journalist said to him, just give us your thoughts. What did it feel like to see the Earth, where human beings come from, so far away and so small? And he said, the only thought I had was, I wish that they'd sent a poet.
Oh,
that's quite nice.
That's ironically poetic in itself, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly.
That's really good. So the Blue Marble, isn't it, they call it?
Yeah.
It's the famous photo of the Blue Marble.
Yeah, exactly, which I think is from one of the earlier Apollo missions. Mm. Yeah, from
beautiful image. It's one of my favorite ever images. I think it's really cool.
And it genuinely had an impact on the eco-conscious, on the climate movement.
Yeah.
Because it's so hard to see yourself from outside of yourself, let alone seeing the whole planet from outside of itself. Once you realize it's just a little... it's a little thing.
Little dot in the distance, yeah.
little wet thing flying through space, and can go wrong, that you start to think, maybe we should look after it.
There's one extra thing as well I want to add to this. Mm-hmm. And isn't it true that, is it Buzz Aldrin punched someone because he gets getting annoyed that people were saying absolutely that he didn't go to the moon?
Yeah.
And eventually just got quite violent.
Which he would. Yeah, you just punched him in the face and knocked him out at the age of like 85.
Yeah.
Brilliant. He just got married again at the age of like 94.
He's a don.
Good for him.
Absolutely. Okay. Oh God, I have a number time. Mm-hmm. And it is 60 per square meter, and your clue is swamps.
60 per square meter. Okay, what is a unacceptable amount of alligators?
I mean, the Everglades in Florida, that kind of thing. It's not.
Stacking them up.
It's just like... okay. Although actually, you know... like, that's of one animal. Mm-hmm. 60 of alligators in one... one square, yeah, that's just like piling on top, isn't it?
That's too many.
That's an art exhibition.
We need a depth. So, I don't know, 60 per square meter. I'm thinking, all I can think of is the kind of plant population, animal population, mosquitoes, that kind of thing. Am I along the right lines?
Yeah, you're on the right line. So swamps may not be... I mentioned this to one of our listeners, Jamie, a good friend of mine, and I said, we're doing something on the swamps. He went, well, that's boring. I went, yeah, I'll try my best. But the swamps may not be those glamorous of ecosystems, but believe it or not, they're actually some of the most productive ecosystems in the world. They're really important. And in fact, swamps have some amazing features that set them apart from other ecosystems. So for example, swamps are incredibly diverse, containing up to 60 different species of plant and animals per square meter.
That's what it is.
Which is...
That is a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah. It's insane. So swamps can also influence the hydrological cycle in a number of ways. Since swamps are wet and spongy, they act like giant sponges, absorbing and filtering water that goes back into the water cycle. Mm-hmm. So they act as massive filtrations. Mm-hmm. So it's a really integral part of the hydrological cycle that water goes through these systems. Mm-hmm. Usually swamps are quite salty as well in some areas, if you have like marine and coastal ones, but they play a huge part in developing sand dunes and spits and also support sort of birds and
ornithology is the study of birds.
Yeah, so
bird watching.
The bird population, I was trying to get all fancy to do it.
The ornithological population.
Yeah, that's the one. I've relied on you there heavily for a word.
Sure, but it would be embarrassing. You lost a couple of middle class points there, if I'm honest.
Fair enough. I realised I just went really loudly than the mic. Whoops, sorry.
Smooth.
So in addition...
You did it again.
Did it again. Yeah. You stop that. In addition, swamps can act as natural carbon sinks, as again, linked to carbon emissions and carbon sinks. You know what a carbon sink is?
It presumably soaks up carbon, spits out oxygen.
It's exactly that.
That kind of thing. Yeah. Like a plant.
Pretty much. And it's one of those things. So this is where if you could, for example, develop a swamp on your land, you could argue that it is a carbon sink and get carbon credits for it, which is quite good for making money because they have value. They act as a weird currency, which governments need to spend on to be able to emit more into the atmosphere. But as a result, it means that other places are reducing the carbon in their area. It's quite a nice little currency in the world. So the amount of ecosystem services provided by swamps each year is estimated to be worth between, and this is quite incredible, $1.5 to $3 trillion.
Wow.
So they're significant.
That's quite a lot of money.
In terms of economically as well.
Yeah.
They're important and valuable ecosystems. And they're not that glamorous because, like, you know, what do you think of when you think of a swamp?
Well, you just think that they stink.
Yeah.
You think of Shrek.
Mostly Shrek. Mostly like mud up to your waist. And... yeah, when I think swamp, I think geographers in waders trying to collect data in the middle of a classy kind of environment, probably raining.
Tell you what, the kind of person who says I love swamps so much, I want to dedicate my life to them. I'm glad that universities exist to look after that kind of person.
Absolutely. Right.
It's like daycare.
It's like at a university, there was, I like this story. So we had to do a module on soil. Mm-hmm. And you have to be a particular kind of person to really be into soil. By the way, soil is really important. We could talk about soil
are that kind of person.
Maybe. But soil is like one of the most important assets that we have as humanity that we easily neglect. And it's so important about, it's linked to everything that we do in our existence. But it's easy to neglect. But we had a lecturer who was well into it. Been doing it for 30 years at university. But his lectures were 2 hours long, but he had a break halfway through. The first hour, there were about 60 students. Second hour, there were 3.
The real soil heads.
Right. I was one of those 3. Not because I was a soil head, because I had so much empathy that I didn't want to leave him alone. But then on reflection, he probably loved soil so much that he didn't care.
He would have been fine. Do you know what? He was probably a bit miffed that not everyone left, because then he could go and hang out with the soil.
That is true.
And start digging around for worms kind of thing.
He was that kind of guy. Yeah, he had a worm farm at the front in the glass tank.
Of course he did.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah,
of course he did.
Like some sort of, is that a vivarium? It's not really, it's a worm case. I don't know what you would call that, the technical name, but
real soil heads, get in touch with us.
Yeah, let us know. Do you want to know where the biggest swamp is in the world?
Well, I mean, you mentioned the Everglades. That's quite a famous one.
It's quite famous, but this isn't in the States. It's in Venezuela.
Uh-huh.
It's the Orinoco Delta in South America, and it covers 41,000 square miles. So times that by 60, that's how many species of there are of animal.
Hang on, Orinoco Delta. That's a lot of animals, but I thought the Orinoco was a tributary of the Amazon. So how can it have its own delta?
Doesn't it go further? There will be a tributary kind of further north in Venezuela. Oh, good point.
Or is it where the Orinoco meets the Amazon? I thought that went into Brazil.
We're going to have to go off and research that one and then come back in the extra episode.
Find out more about the Orinoco next.
Oh, yeah. Next maybe episode. I'll do a whole section on it.
Exactly. And I'll do something about that one Enya song about the Orinoco.
Okay. Fair point, actually. But yeah, my sources did say it was a 41,000 square mile swamp there. Mm-hmm. And it is known for habitats and other wetlands, grass. Yeah. And so on. Sandy beaches as coastal. Yeah. So there's your swamp corner.
Swamp facts.
Swamp facts that you will ever need in your life.
Exactly.
Did I bore myself reading that and doing that? A little bit.
But, I mean, all the swamp boys, nasty boys and swamp girls, they'll be... That was like when an absolute club banger comes on at 2 a.m. for them. They're just hands in the air.
Yeah.
Just going for it.
I think, yeah. I think, do you know what, right? The only link I think everyone can have to swamps, I think you said it earlier, is Shrek.
Absolutely.
That's it.
And there's a lot more animals in real swamps than there are in Shrek.
That's true. There's a donkey. I don't know if there's one of the 68 animals that are native to swamps.
60 per square meter.
Yeah, that's quite a lot.
So I was trying to figure this out whilst you were talking. My bed's about 2 meters long by about, let's say, a meter and a half to 2 meters wide, between 3 and 4 square meters.
Yeah, you're going to have... Yeah, 240.
240 different species of animals.
Yeah.
I mean, there's two when my cat visits. Like, it's cramped.
Well, do you have any bed bugs? That might add it a
little bit. Might be three. Yeah, I hope not.
So that kind of wraps it up. I think I'm swamped, festivaled, and whatever you talked about, Alvin, that doesn't work very well.
Glad to see you were listening.
I was just so excited by swamps. I forgot, it's just brainwashed my whole memory that I couldn't remember anything
absolute
else.
Swamp head.
Yeah. But thank you very much for listening. And if you would like to find out more about us, we do a few things on social media. You can find us on Twitter at GapsPod and also on YouTube. Just search for Gaps in Knowledge Podcast. You'll find us there.
And if you want to email us, it's gapspodcast@outlook.com. He says unconvincingly, trying to remember. And if you, we still want to try out this this feature that you've got on Spotify, which is just scroll down, tap in the description on the message that says leave a message, and then you can get in touch with us. So if you've got a question or a comment or whatever, then please do. Any topics you want us to look at, anything you think would be fun, let us know.
Yeah, and if we've botched any of the socials or anything there, we'll put it in the show notes.
Exactly.
Just look there. You lazy. Yeah,
cool.
See you later.
Bye for now.